Did Jesus really live on this earth? You know, the answer to this question is really the basis of Christianity. If Jesus did not live on this earth, then Christianity is a hoax. There is nothing to it. The historical Jesus is the very foundation of our faith. The rise of rationalism in the 17th and 18th centuries brought a flood of biblical critics who denied the existence of a man called Jesus. These critics, mostly in Germany, I think were enamored with their own scholarship, and they began to attack the credibility of the biblical records. By discrediting the New Testament, likewise discredited the historical Jesus. They began to say that these records that we call the Gospels, the New Testament, these are simply the product of myth and legend, and that they were put together as sort of a scissors and paste arrangement from various sources, and that there's really no basis in historical fact for the man Jesus. Don't have time to look at all of those German theologians. I have a number of them listed in the manuscript, but perhaps we'll look at a couple. Albert Schweitzer, of course, one of the most famous of the German rationalists, 1875 to 1965. He's a well-known philosopher, theologian, and medical missionary. He published his book, Quest for the Historical Jesus, in 1906, and the English translation came out a few years later. But in this book, he said that Jesus never existed, but was a figure designed by rationalism, endowed with life by liberalism, and clothed by modern theology in an historical garb. Well, of course, he was quite popular in his day, and people just lapped that up and said, well, there's really nothing to this Jesus myth. Another man by the name of Adolf von Harnack, and by the way, his textbook was standard reading when I was in Abilene Christian back in 1900, none of your business. But we had to read Harnack in his History of Christianity. Well, he was another church historian and theologian, lived 1851 to 1930. Well, he stressed the fatherhood of God as the basis for the brotherhood of man, and to him, this was the core gospel. Does that remind you of Bill Love, his core gospel? Well, everything else in the gospel, he said, could be attributed to what he called misconceptions and naivete of the first century Judaism with its hopes of divine intervention in history and the restoration of Israel. One of the best known New Testament scholars of the 20th century was Rudolf Bultmann, 1884 to 1976. He was a leader in a movement known as form criticism. According to this method, this is a way that to account for the Gospels, how the Gospel narratives came to be. And according to his method of interpretation, the formation of the Gospels came about in little episodic fragments. There is a little fragment here that we call the parables, and there's another little fragment here, a little story that's circulating orally about the miracles of Jesus and so forth. And over a period of time, these forms just kind of fell together and formed the narratives that we call the Gospels. There were certain editors here that would gather these up and put them together. And so Bultmann suggested then that these oral fragments were, of course, of questionable origin, that the sources for the New Testament documents were fragmentary, legendary, and hence unreliable regarding the information about Jesus. And so he came to the conclusion that the doubt as to whether Jesus really existed is unfounded and not worth refutation. He says, no sane person can doubt that Jesus stands as founder behind the historical movement whose first distinct stage is represented by the oldest Palestinian community. But how far that community preserved an objectively true picture of him and his message is another question. So if you just weed out all of that psychobabble and the theological terminology, what he says is that we don't really have a reliable historical record of Jesus. Oh, he believes in Jesus. These modernists, and all of these fellows that we've listed there from the rationalist school of German theology claim to be believers. Now, they're kind of like the Unitarians. Oh, they believe in Jesus. But what kind of a Jesus do they believe in? They don't believe in an historical Jesus. They don't believe that this man Jesus ever actually lived. You know, it's really difficult for us sometimes to get a grasp of what liberalism is. Because they use the same terminology. Because they use the same words that you and I use. I remember a number of years ago, I was talking with a Bible professor out at Pepperdine University. Good old PU. He was telling about a theological student there that was getting his master's degree, and they were giving him an oral examination. And they have a committee of men setting up there, quizzing this fellow, making him defend his thesis. And one of the professors that's up on this panel is asking questions, and he's making statements relative to the saga of Genesis and the story of Abraham and this kind of language. And finally, one of the professors stopped the proceedings. He asked the chairman, he said, "Would you mind if I ask one of our own teachers a few questions?" And he said, "No, I don't mind. Go ahead." And so he asked this professor, he said, "Do you believe that the Bible is inspired?" "Yes, I believe the Bible is inspired." "Don't you tell me I don't believe the Bible is inspired." "Well, do you believe that God inspired Moses to write the account of the flood?" "Yes, I believe that God inspired Moses to write the account of the flood." "Do you believe that such a thing as a universal flood ever happened?" "Oh, no, I don't believe that at all." "Well, I thought you believed in inspiration." "Oh, I do. I believe God inspired Moses to write that account, but I don't believe it ever happened. I think it was just a story that Noah told for a theological purpose." Now, these fellows, these modernists, believe in Jesus. That's Bultmann is saying, "Oh, Jesus stands as head of this Christian community," and blah, 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 blah. But he doesn't believe that Jesus ever really existed. "We don't have any historical records," he says, "that Jesus ever lived at all." And that's what you come up with when you read these theologians, these modernists. And these are the fellows that are assigned to our preacher boys in schools like Abilene Christian and Pepperdine and others. Well, occasionally, someone will affirm in casual conversation that Jesus is a fictitious character, a fictional person. Now, today, no modern scholar today, or we should say no scholar today, the modernists will still deny these historical records. They still call them into question, but they don't really come out today and deny that Jesus ever really existed, because they know there's too much evidence out there and it destroys their scholarship. But sometimes in casual conversation on talk radio or someplace, you'll hear someone say, "Oh, I don't believe that Jesus ever lived." Maybe they go back and they read some of these German rationalists and they don't bother to read the refutation. But these fellows have been thoroughly discredited, and so there's no reputable scholar today that denies the historical existence of Jesus. The liberals have been so thoroughly discredited that they just don't dare even bring up the subject anymore, because it casts a reflection upon their personal beliefs. F.F. Bruce has said, "Some writers may toy with the fancy of a Christ myth, but they do not do so on the ground of historical evidence. The historicity of Christ is as axiomatic for an unbiased historian as the historicity of Julius Caesar. It is not historians who propagate the Christ myth theories." Another scholar, Otto Betz, concludes that no serious scholar has ventured to postulate the non-historicity of Jesus. And again, John Montgomery, in his book History and Christianity, agrees and asks this question: "What then does a historian know about Jesus Christ? He knows, first and foremost, that the New Testament documents can be relied upon to give an accurate portrait of him. And he knows that this portrait cannot be rationalized away by wishful thinking, philosophical presuppositionalism, or literary maneuvering." All right, so these are some scholars today that are saying, hey, there is no doubt that Jesus was a historical figure. Well, the historicity of Jesus, of course, can be established along several lines. First of all, there are the primary documents of the New Testament itself, the gospel records of the life of Christ. And volumes have been written on the inspiration and authority of the Scripture, and especially in regard to the gospel. So we don't have time to deal with that, but we can place our faith and our trust in the authenticity, the genuineness, and the authority of the gospel records in regard to the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. Secondly, we can establish the historicity of Jesus by the testimony of unbelievers who testify to the historical existence of Jesus Christ. And finally, the impact of Christianity on the world. All of these things stack up as evidence to demonstrate the historical nature of Jesus Christ. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the documents of the New Testament. The historical integrity of the New Testament has been thoroughly established. They were contemporary with Jesus and wrote within 60 years or so of Christ's death. Of the 27 books, no less than 10 were penned by personal companions of the Lord. Paul, an eyewitness of the resurrection, or of the resurrected Christ, wrote 14 of the remaining books. F.F. Bruce makes this statement: at a very early date, it appears that the four Gospels were united in one collection. They must have been brought together very soon after the writing of the Gospel according to John. This fourfold collection was known originally as the Gospel in the singular, not the Gospel in the plural. There was only one Gospel narrated in four records, distinguished as according to Matthew, according to Mark, and so on. About 115, that is the year 115, Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch, refers to the Gospel, sans phrase, he means the fourfold collection, which went by that name. And so here you are in the very early part of the second century, the fourfold Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are intact and are being referred to by these early Christian writers as the Gospel. This is, as he points out, in the singular, one Gospel. You've got four accounts of the one Gospel of Jesus Christ. Even a liberal theologian like John A.T. Robinson has conceded the authenticity and genuineness of the New Testament records, much to the chagrin of his liberal colleagues. Time and again, the New Testament record of the life of Christ has been demonstrated to be historically accurate. So the New Testament, even modernist scholars, even liberals, have to bow the knee and admit that these records are indeed accurate. The people, places, events, and doctrines of the New Testament have been verified through history, geography, science, and archaeology. And again, volumes have been written on each of these phases of evidence for the inspiration authority of the Bible. And so you just need to go ferret those things out, but the evidence is there. From the New Testament, we learn a number of significant facts. First of all, we learn that Jesus was born in Palestine during the reign of Herod the Great, who died in 4 B.C., by the way. And you note Matthew chapter 2, verse 1, Luke chapter 1, verse 5. We also learn that Augustus was Caesar in Rome at the Lord's birth, Luke chapter 2, verse 1. We learn also that Jesus preached in the towns and villages of Palestine from Galilee to Judea in a ministry that lasted some 3.5 years. Jesus died in Jerusalem under the hand of Governor Pontius Pilate while Tiberius Caesar was emperor of Rome, Matthew 27, verse 2, Mark 15, 1, Luke 13, 1, and John 18, verse 29. Now, these are some indisputable facts that we glean from the Gospels. These facts are set forth, as we have noted, and can be confirmed by secular history. We need to make note of the fact that the Bible is a historical document. It is steeped in history. Notice all of the names of various political leaders that are mentioned in the Bible. You compare that with books like the Koran, for example, written by one man over a very short period of time. It's not historical in that it gives an historical account of a whole nation over a long period of time, or the historical account of one man over a significant period of time. But the New Testament records give an account of history. And therefore, it can be checked by history. And you go back and look at the historical records that are available to us, and time and time and time again, everything that we read of in the New Testament documents are confirmed by history, by science, by geography, and by archaeology. Well, we have to move on. We don't have time to deal with all of that kind of information. Again, there are volumes been written on that, and you need to seek those out. But we move on to the testimony of unbelieving Jews and pagans. Now, there are a number of sources that we can look to, historical documents themselves in their own right, that talk about Jesus. Well, if the man never existed, why would they bring him up? First of all, let's look at the Talmud. The Talmud has been called the second greatest literary achievement in Hebrew and Aramaic after the Bible. It contains the interpretation of Jewish rabbis of the Law of Moses over a period of nearly a 1,000 years, from about 450 B.C. to 500 A.D. Now, the Talmud is made up of two parts. The Mishnah, which is the law code of the Jews, known as the traditions of the elders, handed down orally and then later codified by Jewish rabbis from about 135 to 200 A.D. And then the Gemara was a commentary on the Mishnah. So you've got this oral tradition that was handed down, and then commentaries on that. Let me just illustrate it this way. You still have Jewish rabbis in, for example, in New York, that are still writing Hebrew tradition, because you've got the Torah, the Law of Moses, but the Talmud is sort of a running commentary on that. As you go along, you've got to interpret what these laws mean. For example, the law that has to do with the Sabbath day. And you can't do any work on the Sabbath day. Well, the word work in the Hebrew language has to do with changing nature. So that means you can't build a fire. You can't start a fire on Saturday. Why? Because you've changed nature. Well, all right, in the passing of time, we have the internal combustion engine comes along. Now, what are you going to do? How are you going to interpret that? Can you go out and stick the key in the ignition and turn on your car's motor, because there's a spark that comes from that spark plug and ignites the gasoline, and you have changed nature? So they bring the question to the rabbis. What do we do about this? Well, start your car on Friday night and leave it running. You know? But you see, that's what we're talking about when we talk about the Talmud. It's that kind of thing. It's a running interpretation. Well, all of this is going on, you see, during the lifetime of Jesus. These Jewish rabbis certainly were no friends of Christianity. F.F. Bruce says, according to the early rabbis, whose opinions are recorded in these writings, what we call the Talmud, Jesus of Nazareth was a transgressor in Israel. He's one who practiced magic, scorned the words of the wise, led the people astray, and said he had not come to destroy the law, but to add to it. That's a little bit of a twist on Matthew 5:17. He was hanged on Passover Eve for heresy and misleading the people. His disciples, of whom five are named, healed the sick in his name. Well, F.F. Bruce, one of the great New Testament scholars and a conservative scholar at that, has just boiled this down for us so we don't have to go reading all through the Talmud. Here are some facts that are gleaned from the Talmud, including a description of the destruction of Jerusalem as foretold by Jesus, Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 through 34. The fact that Judaism is in the first century was being overwhelmed by bad opinions. The Talmud said that Judaism was being overwhelmed by bad opinions. What do you suppose that was? Christianity. Synagogues were turned into brothels, they said. Well, that, of course, was a slander against Christianity. James chapter 2, verse 2 indicates that whole synagogues were being converted to Christ. And then they make allusions to Mary as an unchaste woman, and allusions to Jesus. Here in the Talmud, we read of his birth, his flight to Egypt, his miracles and death. And of course, they do this in a derogatory manner. But you don't try to discredit someone who does not exist. It makes me wonder, where was this material when Bultmann was writing his books on theology and demythologizing the Bible? So for those who deny the historicity of Jesus, the fact that the Jews try to discredit him is an insurmountable obstacle. You just don't try to discredit someone who is non-existent. Well, next we turn to the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. Josephus was born in Palestine about 37 AD, and he died in the early part of the second century. He wrote several books, among those History of the Jewish Wars from 170 BC to AD 73, some seven volumes. He wrote a 20-volume set called Jewish Antiquities, and here he records the history of Israel from Genesis down to his own day. He wrote A Vindication of the Jews, known as Against Appian, and he wrote an autobiography. Well, in reviewing the material in Josephus, we just boil this down to about five main points. These are some things that we can glean from reading Josephus. By the way, you might want to try this little exercise sometime. let me show you how this is done. Let me see here. I may just take a minute to do this. Several years ago when I was in school, I was given an assignment to take a newspaper clipping and see what we can glean from it. And so I have a little newspaper clipping that came from the Denver Post January 15th, 1970. I believe I was a student at Bear Valley School of Preaching at that time. And this was an assignment that was given to me by one of the teachers there. And we want to see what we can glean from this. And then you take this and apply it to any of these historical documents. What can you glean from Josephus? What can you glean from the Talmud? Well, here's a little article that I clipped from the paper. Postal workers ponder strike. New York. AP. A survey is being conducted to find out if about 20,000 New York metropolitan area postal workers would strike for higher wages. Gustav J. Johnson, president of Metropolitan Postal Council, said Friday the survey would determine whether postal workers would strike nationally, locally, or not at all. He said some workers were dissatisfied with Congress's delay in acting on President Nixon's $175 million pay raise proposal. Very short little article. What can you glean from that? Let's suppose that 200 years from now, archaeologists dig up the Denver Post and find this little article. And they don't know anything about a man by the name of Nixon. Could you learn from this little piece that there was a president by the name of Nixon? Well, not only that, but here are some things you can glean. There's a city called New York. There's an organization known as the Associated Press, responsible for this short but instructive news item. A survey is being conducted in New York. This survey is to find out if 20,000 New York metropolitan area postal workers will strike for higher wages. There are New York City postal workers. there is a place called New York. You see, I won't read all of that, but you read these historical documents like Josephus, and what can you glean from them? All right, here are just five main points. Josephus shows that the messianic hope was not only prevalent among the Jews of the first century, but that it was the principal occasion for the last wars of the Jews. It was because they were so had such a fever pitch for the Messiah, and somebody's going to come and to overthrow Rome. And you can read in the New Testament records of the zealots who were so anxious to make Jesus their Savior, not in the sense of saving the soul, but in the political sense. That's why Jesus had to declare before Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight. But now is my kingdom not from hence." But so Josephus tells about this fever pitch of the messianic hope. Secondly, John the Baptizer appeared in Judea in the time of Herod. Also, that he was recognized as a reformer and one of good reputation. John was unjustly imprisoned and put to death by Herod. All this right out of Josephus. And then Josephus testifies to the fact that all the political persons in Judea, Galilee, and the surrounding countries mentioned in the New Testament, as well as all of the historical events mentioned in the New Testament, actually were as the Scriptures set them forth. You read the New Testament, compare those political persons and historical events, and there they are, right there in Josephus. And then the destruction of Jerusalem is described by Josephus precisely as Moses and Jesus had predicted, Deuteronomy 28, verse 54, and Matthew 24, verse 21. Now, here's a little quotation from Josephus, and some have tried to discount this, but F.F. Bruce has done an excellent job, as well as Brother Wayne Jackson, in demonstrating the validity of this passage. But here's just a little quotation from Josephus. He says, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians, so named for him, are not extinct at this day." So F.F. Bruce sums up the testimony of Josephus. He says, "We have therefore very good reason for believing that Josephus did make reference to Jesus bearing witness to his date, his reputation as a wonder worker, his being the brother of James, his crucifixion under Pilate at the instigation of the Jewish rulers, his messianic claim, his being the founder of the tribe of Christians, and probably the belief in his rising from the dead." So there are just some of the facts that we can gain from Josephus. Now, there are numerous others that we have in the manuscript that I'll just have to refer you to. I don't have time to deal with Tacitus and Suetonius and Thallus. These are all very important historical writers. These men corroborate so much of what we read in the New Testament. But we move on then to the testimony of early Christian writers from about AD 70 to 350. AD, are the middle of the 4th century. These writings, some of them we call the apostolic fathers. I don't like that term because it sounds a little bit Catholic. They're not our fathers in the spiritual sense, but we can perhaps refer to them in the same sense we've referred to George Washington as the father of our country. But these writers left us a vast amount of written material regarding Jesus Christ. These are men, some of them, their lives overlap the lives of the apostles, and were students of the apostles. Men like Polycarp, for example, was a student of the apostle John. Now, the others, we can't always say that they were men who were students of these apostles, but they were very close to that period of time. We do have adequate evidence to demonstrate that Polycarp was a disciple of the Apostle John. Then you have a group of writing known as the Apologists. And these were men who wrote formal literary defenses of Christianity from about 125 to 250 A.D. And the word apology, by the way, is from the Greek word apologia, which means to make a defense. So these men were writing a defense of Christianity. Now, in writing a defense of Christianity, oftentimes they would take on the critics of Christianity, and those then who would try to discredit and discount the Christian message. And one of these critics was a man by the name of Celsus. Now, Celsus wrote a book about 177 A.D. called The True Word, in which he attacked the life of Christ and quoted some 80 passages from the New Testament and tried to attack the teaching of Jesus. Well, none of his works survive today. You can't go over to the library and pull out a volume of the True Word. It's gone. But it has been preserved in the works of a man by the name of Origen, who lived 185 to 254 A.D. And Origen answered the arguments that Celsus made. And incidentally, they're basically the same kind of ridiculous arguments that some of the liberals make today. But in answering those arguments, there are a number of things that are demonstrated clearly. And again, we ask the question, why would someone try to discredit a person who never lived? And so Alexander Campbell said that Celsus has given us perhaps more information and arguments that demonstrate the truthfulness of Christianity, perhaps more than anyone who tried to make a defense of Christianity. So that becomes a very valuable source. And of course, then we have the impact of Christianity on the world as one of the ways that we establish the historicity of Jesus Christ. Can you imagine a movement such as Christianity, a doctrine, a philosophy, a way of life being based upon a fictional character, somebody like Robin Hood or Paul Bunyan? It's absurd when you stop to think about the impact of Christianity on the world and the way that Christianity has impacted art and literature and science and ethics and commerce. Now, Dr. Philip Schaff, one of the world's greatest church historians, made this observation concerning the influence of Jesus Christ. He said, "This Jesus of Nazareth, without money and arms, conquered more millions than Alexander, Caesar, Muhammad, and Napoleon. Without science and learning, he shed more light on things human and divine than all philosophers and scholars combined. Without the eloquence of schools, he spoke such words of life as were never spoken before or since, and produced effects which lie beyond the reach of orator or poet. Without writing a single line, he set more pens in motion and furnished themes for more sermons, orations, discussion, learned volumes, works of art, and songs of praise than the whole army of great men of ancient and modern times." And so indeed, the impact of Christianity upon the world is one of the great evidences of the historical Jesus. Jesus is a fact. The New Testament records furnish indisputable evidence, as well as the testimony of unbelieving Jews and pagans, that Jesus really lived. Secular history is replete with information about Jesus of Nazareth. Today, there are no credible scholars who would argue that Jesus did not live. Only someone who is ignorant of both Bible and history may suggest such a ridiculous notion. But now it remains for us to answer the question that Jesus posed to the Pharisees: what do you think of Christ? Whose son is he? Matthew 22:42. Was he just a man among men, just a philosopher among philosophers? Or is he indeed the Son of the living God? We talked in the last session about the great confession, the good confession. And here is the proof of the fact that Jesus is who he claimed to be, the Son of God. And so we cannot have it both ways. Either Jesus was a fraud and a lunatic, or else he was, as he claimed to be, the Son of God. C.S. Lewis made this observation: "A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." And so Jesus either is who he claimed to be, or he is the greatest fraud of all history. And if he did not exist historically, then Christianity itself is the greatest fraud of all history. May God help his people everywhere to press the claims of the historical Jesus upon this and coming generations. Thank you.